Shaw, I would like to thank our debaters for participating in this next event. I address the question, does the Christian God exist? Secularism versus Christianity. Arguing for secularism will be Elliot Redfern. Mr. Redfern is a doctoral student in the Princeton University Religion Department, who is working on a book examining the Middle East Project and the Jewish philosophy. Taking aside for Christianity will be Dr. Phil Fernandez, founder and president of the Institute for Biblical Defense in the Seattle area of Washington. Dr. Fernandez received his PhD in philosophy of religion from Greenwich University and currently teaches at Kent State Bible College. He has lectured and debated in defense of Christianity at a number of universities across the country. I'd also like to thank the sponsors of tonight's debate, as well as those individuals who helped make it possible, particularly Larry Jones and Christine Darrow. Please take a few moments after the debate to look at the various materials to your left there. The format of tonight's debate will be as follows. Dr. Fernandez will speak for 20 minutes. Mr. Redfern will then speak for 20 minutes. Then there will be 10 minute rebuttals and time for questions. Princeton philosophy professor Katie Rosen will be our moderator. Please join me in welcoming Professor Rosen.
The frame of mind in which to engage this debate is as follows. See if you can do this. Pretend you have no opinion on the question whether God exists, whether the Christian God exists, whether secularism is correct or not. Pretend you're open-minded. Pretend you want to know the answer to this question. And now, see what these two guys can do to persuade you one way or the other. Even if you do have an opinion, your assessment as to the rationality of that opinion should turn on how persuasive you think these remarks and similar remarks might be. So, see what you can do to assess this sort of debate in that spirit, and I won't go on. Let's start with Dr. Fernandez.
I'd like to thank Vincent Loy for inviting me to this debate, Elliot Ratzman for agreeing to debate me, and Gideon Rosen for agreeing to moderate this debate. Just want to let you know I consider it an honor to speak at Princeton. In fact, the last and only time I was at Princeton was in 1975. I was at Essex Catholic High School on the corner of A's in Jersey. And back in 75, I competed in ninth grade state track meet. So it's been a long time. And let's just hope that I do better tonight than I did 75. Otherwise, I probably won't be back at Princeton for another 26 years. Tonight, I will defend what C.S. Lewis called mere Christianity. This is the belief that a personal God exists who has uniquely revealed himself in and through Jesus of Nazareth. I will provide evidence that it is more reasonable to believe in the existence of a personal God than it is to reject its existence. I will also show that the historical data accepted by the majority of New Testament scholars today is more plausibly explained by the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth than by any alternative theory. The beginning of the universe. This argument is as follows. Whatever began to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause. Premise number one uses the law of causality. Non-being cannot cause being. In other words, from nothing, nothing comes. Since nothing is nothing, it can do nothing. Therefore, it can cause nothing. Hence, whatever began to exist needs a cause for its existence. Premise number two contends that the universe had a beginning. Scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe includes the second law of thermodynamics, also known as energy deterioration, and the Big Bang model. Second law of thermodynamics is one of the most firmly established laws of modern science. It states that the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. It means that someday in the finite future, all the energy in the universe will be useless, unless there is intervention from outside the universe. In other words, universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. At one time in the finite past, all the energy in the universe was usable. Since the universe is winding down, it must have been wound up. The universe is not eternal, it had to have a beginning, and since it had a beginning, it needs a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. The Big Bang model also indicates that the universe had a beginning. This model shows that as time moves forward, the universe is expanding in all directions, much like the effects of an explosion. But this means that if we were able to go back in time, the physical universe would get smaller and smaller until there would be no physical universe. Scientists call this point of space or point of infinite density. Therefore, the physical universe began out of nothing a finite time ago. This means that space, matter, and time had a beginning. Since the universe had a beginning, it had to have a cause. Once again, for from nothing, nothing comes. But to reach this present effect called the universe, there had to have been an eternal, uncaused first cause. For it is impossible to traverse an infinite set of causes and effects to reach the present effect. There had to be a first cause. Since intelligence cannot come from non-intelligence, the cause of the universe must be an intelligent. Since nature is non-moral, but morality exists in the universe, the cause of the universe must be a moral being. This means that the cause of the universe is a personal being. The design and order found in the universe. The order, design, and complexity found in the universe strongly imply that the universe is not a random together of atoms. Rather, it is the product of intelligent design. Therefore, it had an intelligent designer. Contemporary scientists have found numerous evidences for design in the universe. A few examples will suffice. First, the slightest variation in the expansion rate of the universe would render the universe capable of sustaining life. Second, astrophysicist Ulos has listed 25 narrowly defined parameters that the universe had to have in order for life to be possible. Ross also pointed out 32 narrowly defined parameters for life concerning the Earth, its moon, its sun, and its galaxy. For instance, if the distance between the Earth and the sun was to differ by just 2% in either direction, no life on Earth would be possible. These parameters for life on Earth clearly show evidence of design and purpose. Third, British scientists Boyle and Wagramasinghe estimated that the chances of life evolving from the random shuffling of organic molecules is virtually zero. They calculated that there was only one chance in 10 to the 20th power to form a single enzyme, and just one chance in 10 to the 40,000th power to produce the approximately 2,000 enzymes that exist. However, Boyle and Wagramasinghe point out that the production of enzymes is only one step in the generation of life. Therefore, they concluded that there must be some type of cosmic intelligence to explain the origin of life. Boyle compared the probability of life spontaneously generating from life as equivalent to the chances of a tornado randomly producing a Boeing 747 from a junkyard. Fourth, the cell is the basic unit of life. The DNA molecule of a single-celled animal contains enough complex information to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. An explosion in a print shop will never produce one volume of an encyclopedia. That amount of information necessitates an intelligent cause. Fifth, the human brain contains more genetic information than the information found in the world's largest libraries. There is no way that this amount of information could be produced by mere chance. Intelligent intervention is needed. Sixth, molecular biologist Michael Behe has shown that the irreducible complexity found on the molecular level cannot be explained without appealing to intelligent design. The theistic hypothesis of intelligent design is more plausible than the atheistic hypothesis of random chance. the existence of absolute moral values. We all make moral value judgments when we call the actions of another person wrong. When we do this, we appeal to a moral law or standard. This moral law originates in the individual. For them, we could not call the actions of another person, such as Adolf Hitler, wrong. The moral law is not the creation of each society or culture. For then, one society cannot call the actions of another society, such as Nazi Germany, wrong. The moral law doesn't come from a world consensus, for world consensus is often mistaken. The world once thought that the earth was flat, the sun revolved around the earth, and slavery was morally acceptable. Therefore, in order to make sense of our moral experience, there exists a moral law above all individuals, societies, and any world consensus. This absolute moral law must be eternal and unchanging if we are to condemn the actions of the past, i.e. slavery, the Holocaust, etc. The moral law is not descriptive of the way things are, as is the case with natural laws. Rather, it is prescriptive, or it prescribes the way things ought to be. Prescriptive laws need a prescriber. Therefore, a moral lawgiver must exist, and this lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging. The absurdity of life without God. What hope can an atheist offer mankind? People on their deathbeds don't usually call an atheist to comfort them. Normally a preacher or a priest. Even an atheist could guarantee us 70 years of happiness. What good would that be when compared with the eternity of non-existence that follows? If there is no God, then Hitler will not be punished for his evil deeds. And Mother Teresa will not be rewarded for her generous works of charity. If there is no God, then a million years from now, it would make no difference if you were a Hitler or a Mother Teresa. Can life have any ultimate meaning if there is no God? If non-existence is what awaits us, can we really make sense of life? You live, and then you die. There are no eternal consequences. Hitler and Mother Teresa have the same destiny. We all finish our meaningless journeys in total nothingness. Famous atheist Bertrand Russell wrote that man is a product of causes which had no provision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves, and his beliefs are but the collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human beings are destined to extinction in the vast system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of the universe in ruins. Immediately following that statement, Russell referred to his atheistic philosophy as the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Without God, life is without meaning. However, if there is a God, then there is hope. The God of the Bible guarantees the defeat of evil and the triumph of good. He guarantees that Hitler will receive his punishment and Mother Teresa will receive her reward. God gives life meaning for how we choose to live our lives. God is our reason to be optimistic about the future. Only He can overcome our fear of death. Only He can defeat evil. Without God, meaningless existence is all we face. Without God, there is no hope. Evidence for Jesus' resurrection. Christians believe that God has uniquely revealed Himself in and through Jesus of Nazareth. Today, most New Testament scholars acknowledge that Jesus acted and spoke as if He believed that He possessed unique divine authority, that He saw in Himself the coming of God's kingdom, and that He believed that each person trusted in Him. The ultimate vindication of Jesus' message and ministry is His bodily resurrection from the dead. There are several pieces of evidence for Christ's resurrection. First, the resurrection accounts are not legends. The New Testament has more manuscript evidence of Israel reliability than any other ancient writing. It has more copies, a higher degree of agreement between its copies, and a smaller gap between the oldest existing copy and the date of the original composition. No other ancient writing comes close to the New Testament in manuscript evidence. Old Testament scholars now date the Gospels within the lifetime of eyewitnesses of the life of Jesus, roughly between 40 and 100 AD. Some New Testament scholars even date the Synoptic Gospels as early as the 30s to 50s AD. John Wenham, Jean Carmack, Claude Trismontin. John, the entire New Testament was written before 70 AD. Renowned archaeologist William F. Albright dated the Gospels between 40 and 70 AD. The majority of the New Testament scholars dated most of the New Testament letters from 48 AD to 64 AD. The apostolic fathers were the pupils of the apostles, whom the apostles selected to lead the early church. They wrote between 95 AD and 156 AD, which marks the death of Polycarp, one of the Apostle John's pupils. They confirmed the apostolic message that Jesus claimed to be God and Savior and bodily rose from the dead. Most researchers, the Jewish historian Josephus, who lived from 37 to 97 AD, believe that Josephus' account of Jesus' resurrection was later amended by Christian copies. Still, the majority of these researchers accept a shorter reading of this passage as authentic. But even if the shorter reading of Josephus acknowledges that the first generation church believed and proclaimed that Jesus had risen from the dead, New Testament scholars almost universally date Paul's first writings at about the mid-50s AD. Chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, Paul passes on to his readers an ancient creed or hymn that gives a summary list of the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. Jesus' appearances to the apostles, to Peter, to James, and to all people at one time are recorded in this creed or hymn. Paul then adds to this creed or hymn his own eyewitness account of Jesus' appearance to him. Many New Testament scholars believe that Paul received this creed from James and Peter when he visited them in Jerusalem between 33 and 38 AD. Some scholars also date the pre-Markan passion and empty tomb narrative, Mark chapters 14, 15, and 16, to the 30s AD. Here's the reason why this is important. A.N. Sherwin White, a leading historian in ancient Roman times, has shown that twofold is not time for legends to wipe out core historical facts. As a professional historian, Sherwin White argues that New Testament critics are incorrect for rejecting the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts. Not enough time to wipe out the of the New Testament. Second, because of the strong evidence for the resurrection accounts, the following eight facts are widely accepted by New Testament scholars today. Jesus died by crucifixion. Number two, he was buried in Joseph's tomb. Number three, the tomb was found empty by female followers of Jesus. Number four, the original disciples, as well as other individuals and groups, believed they had seen Jesus risen from the dead. Number five, the church experienced rapid growth in Jerusalem. The resurrection was there. Number six, changed by what he believed to be a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus. Number seven, James' life was transformed by what he believed to be a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus. And number eight, the disciples, Orthodox Jews, changed the day of worship to Sunday. Third, alternative naturalistic theories proposed to explain the historical data have failed. This is widely admitted by New Testament scholars today. The apostles were sincere enough about their proclamation of the resurrection to die martyrs' deaths for their beliefs. Men do not die for what they know to be a hoax. All theories involving apostolic deception are thus dismissed. Proposed hallucination theories have also been rejected, since they do not explain either the empty tomb or the various conditions in which resurrection appearances occur. The only plausible explanation of the historical data is that Jesus of Nazareth did indeed rise from the dead. The rejection of Jesus' resurrection appears to be based not upon historical, but upon God. But if a personal God exists, and there are reasons to believe that he does, then miracles are possible. In conclusion, I have shown that belief in the existence of a personal God is more reasonable than the doubt of his existence. In the person of Jesus of Nazareth by raising him from the dead. For my opponent to refute my thesis, he must show that atheism is more reasonable than belief in a personal God, and he must provide an alternative naturalistic theory with more explanatory power for the resurrection. Thank you, and God bless you.
Universe full of evil, suffering, absurdity, and human condition as we have this certain goal of despair and sadness. But can we really say the world does appear beautiful in many senses, that there's a priori necessary need for one single concept of the universe? I'm going to be agnostic on this point. What I do want to written over almost 2,000 years ago, is not a reliable source. Base one's life, believe that one is facing a people who are unsafe that they are not Christians. Now, we do have a significant number of manuscripts, Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, known as the Apostolic Letters. We have over 5,400, the smallest in size of credit cards. Significant doctrinal ideas. Let's start with some contradictions. There are small contradictions. If this is the word, things together. These contradictions should work out. And there's certainly a tradition of Christian apologetics which tries to work these out. But let me start small. There are two genealogies of Joseph, father and stepfather of Jesus. These two genealogies are different. Absolutely different. One has 26 generations, one has Judas die? Does anybody know? Did he just embow himself? Many Christians will say it's in the text. It's right there. Now, the only text, there's two texts that seem to resemble what we might say is the Trinity. John 5, 7, 8. There are three witnesses, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, in my translation from the Oxford Study Bible. These are not really verses of the Trinity that stands. And as it turns out, this phrase only appears in the Latin Bible, not in the Sanskrit manuscript before the 14th century. So we can't rather than serve it later. And naturalists, or I should say, many Christian biblical scholars are claiming that a lot of these doctrines were inserted later in order to justify retroactively certain decided upon ideas about what the Christian believed. In Matthew 28, we find Jesus telling his disciples to go out and preach to all the nations. While the Great Commission does not make mention of the three persons who later become components of the Trinity. He says, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And that's mentioned in the Mark, which is considered even by Craig as the earliest gospel. Okay? Later, in the Council of Nicaea, in 325, the doctrine of the Trinity was hammered out. And this was hammered out in a lot there were a lot of variations in different areas in what ended up becoming the Trinity. And the Trinity details weren't really worked out until the council passed it on in 451. So that takes more life commitments. Few ideas about absolute salvation of your group based on some questionable historical accuracy is a entry to handle a complete lifestyle, such a lifestyle which persecutes, kills, and discriminates, and has throughout time non-Christians, non-believers, and even Christians who disagree with specific points of doctrine in Christianity. I only have a few minutes left. Let me say a few words about this.